At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to Activate Yourself with Gita Sidhu-Rab, where we feature otherwise normal people who, because of events in their life, have turned left and done unusual, inspiring, incredible things, like build a business, become a happiness expert, marry a prince, create an empire, or like your host, set up a health and wellness business, Nosh Detox. Here's your host, Gita Sidhu-Rab.
Hi, my name is Gita Sidhu-Rab, and today we are going to take head on the concept of what the hell happens when the world's going to hell. Because if you're in a place where there is immense amount of turmoil, things are always changing, and you just as a company, as people that work in an organization, as a professional, literally have no idea what is going to happen to the organizations you run. But also for the people that work in the organization, there's no level of stability. Mass levels of instability are emotionally highly debilitating. They override the impulse of purpose, they override the impulse of impact, and they override immensely the purpose of inspiration. You just are not inspired when you're struggling to work out if you're going to survive. So today's guest is going to tell us all about that. So we have the gorgeous Marina Meyer here, who has just recently become WCourse certified, which I'm super excited about. And you're an organizational psychologist, right?
That's correct. Yes.
I did not know what that was. And I'm sure you don't.
Most people don't.
We're going to find that out right now, Marina. Welcome. Great. And what is an organizational psychologist?
Great question. So an organizational psychologist is essentially a social psychologist that's looking at social dynamics and psychology at group levels within organizational life and organizational structures. So there's a couple of different branches of psychology, and a lot of people focus in business at what's called the industrial psychology level, which is the individual kind of psychometric assessments, what's your strengths, and that's really important for things like talent development. But there's a whole nother layer that happens when you can begin to put people together in groups and see how they behave together and see how they manage through change and how they create purpose and whether or not they feel like they belong and how that contributes to performance. And so all these things are social phenomenons and require an extra layer of analysis or a kind of a zoomed out view. And that's really where social psychology and organizational psychology comes in.
And so how is it that, because when I've spoken to you, I often hear you use the word to embody a kind of a change. How do you, like, when should people talk to you? So, because I want to then ask how you help them, because you've talked about in times of immense change, like when you, like one of the examples of one of my clients is when you buy a company and you're merging that company, those two companies together, that's highly stressful for everyone involved.
Yes. And highly turbulent. And a lot of M&A situations fail because of that. And because they are really hard to navigate well. And so essentially, you kind of called it out. The areas that we particularly are helpful in Sway, which is the consultancy that I've co-founded, and we come in times of what we call growth turbulence. And turbulence has become the norm in the world that we're living in right now. And what we often see is that the companies who are able to navigate that successfully have something that we call readiness and resilience. So the ability to prepare for in an agile way and build competency to and then navigate through change. And that competency is quite hard to nail down because it's something that just doesn't happen at an individual level. Like I mentioned before, it's happening at a social level when it comes to how you communicate, how you learn together, how you face challenging situations as a group. And so that's really where we focus. We focus in times of high turbulence, whether it's planned turbulence, like around capital injections with around M&A, or whether it's unplanned turbulence. And that can be post, mass cut redundancies where there's a lot of trust lost. And so those are really our sweet spot moments, is coming alongside businesses and helping them understand the leading indicators of what success can look like during that time and help their leaders prepare to navigate that well.
Because one of the things that you just said, people don't understand that getting good, immense good fortune is also highly turbulent, right?
Yes,
Like
yes.
when you have an organization that suddenly gets a huge influx of money and you're like, oh my God, what do I do with this? That's actually a very, very hard thing to do. And people have no understanding that that in itself requires management, because you can die from unexpected rapid success as much as you can from unexpected
Exactly.
rapid problems.
Yeah.
How, so if people come to you, what is it that then you're telling them to do?
That's a great question. So we, as social scientists, we really use a social science approach, which means that everything has to be evidence-based and context-based. So we're really wanting to understand what's the specific context of the situation, what's happening here, and how can we get data to help us drive and design solutions that really make sense for that particular
So is
context.
the data coming from the organization or from research that you have that you're bringing in, or both?
Great question. Both. Yeah. So what
Okay.
we're doing is we're doing a combination of consulting literature and other studies that are happening on mass scales that really inform us about what works generally in organizations. And then we're doing a lot of discovery in-house with the experts in the business on the context, which is the people who are doing the work day in and day out. They really understand the challenges, the nuances of the business. And that's where really the rich data is. And so by building these deep kind of partnerships with our clients, we're able to create targeted custom solutions with them that really make sense for their particular group. But there are some consistent things that go all the way across, which is making sure that we're doing, finding the data. So doing some type of deep discovery process and then working with leaders to co-create solutions and teach them how to actually implement them themselves. So rather than being that practitioner that you always have to come back to every time for the rest of your life, every week for the rest of your life, we're trying to build that competency so they can manage that themselves and really own their own leadership of this area long term. And so it's a lot of embedding of those tools.
Okay, do you have any like examples of them? So that makes, because like I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, well, okay, but that doesn't mean anything in my day to day.
Yeah. Exactly. Great question. So we have a client that we have walked through an M&A situation with, and what it's looked like for us is we have a couple things that we're working with on. The first is helping understanding how the leaders feel about the change, and then providing very practical training about how to lead through that change with their workforce. So when they were acquired, what does that actually mean? What should they specifically be saying? Creating guidelines and training around this is what you can expect in terms of a reaction psychologically from your workforce, and these are the ways that you can create security, stability, motivation through that kind of dip post acquisition.
It's almost like having kind of anchors, like to hold everybody.
And then we've created listening programs and a proprietary index that measures how the workforce is doing and how the workforce feels about the business, really using what the research shows us is leading indicators for attrition, retention, performance, all these things that the business actually cares about. We're looking at from a psychological lens to understand what is actually happening in the psyche of the workforce that
How do
can
you do that
predict.
then? How do you describe, for example, attrition or churn psychologically instead of as a number? Because like at W Corp, what we're interested in is like, for example, there are two levels of broken pipelines with women, usually about 5 years in and usually around 40, 45 is when women tend to leave. So how would we then say psychologically explain something like that kind of thing?
Yeah. So there are some really great metrics that have been proven over and over again, which is asking questions around your intentions to leave in the next year actually has some pretty strong correlation with
Do
whether or
people
not that
tell you they're
person.
going to leave?
Yeah. So in surveys, you can say, you can ask a question like, I've thought about leaving in the last 3 months, and you can do that as a frequency scale. So often, rarely, never, always, all the time kind of thing. And then you can also say, on an agreement scale, how sure are they that they're going to be in the organization a year from now? And those things actually have quite good predictors of attrition and retention. And then what we've done is we've also asked loads of other psychological questions around how they're feeling about the business, about accountability in the business, about the standardization of kind of fair procedures and processes for different types of people, for the reward system, for whether or not they're being coached, whether or not they're safe to bring up issues or have conflict
So
with team
are you kind
members.
of picking these as fragile points, which you then give weight?
Yeah, so we're doing kind of a survey of all these aspects that have been proven: psychological safety, distributed leadership, trust and care, these different areas that there's a lot of evidence that it contributes to engagement. And then we run regression analysis and look at the correlation factors to see which particular factors are most strongly associated in that workforce with the likelihood to leave. And so then we know what the levers are. So if your
Give me an
workforce,
example.
yeah, so one of the clients that we've just worked with, one of the biggest correlated factors for intentions to leave is the fact that they don't feel like their team has resilience to deal with problems, and that they don't have like conflict competence in handling hard conversations together. So that particular question had some of the strongest correlation, and because we had a big enough subset of the demographic, we were able to kind of prove statistical significance that there was a correlation between this lack of psychological safety and conflict competence and resilience in the teams with the like, I'm sick of this and I'm thinking about leaving. And so now we know that that's the area of all the, 40 different things that we've measured. That's the one thing that we should really begin to focus on. And we're also able to kind of splice that by demographics and understand, is this a gendered issue? Is this a pay structure issue? Is it a divisional issue? Where is it showing up in the demographic most strongly, and which demographics are at risk? And it's really interesting when you start to look at the gender data to
Okay, hold
see.
on. Let's go for a quick break. And then when we come back, tell me all about the gender data.
Great.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, so we're back. Tell me about the gender data.
Yeah, so it's interesting because with gender data, there's two ways that you have to look at it. The first way that you need to look at it is what is socially acceptable on self-reporting. So when we're looking at resilience, for instance, which huge parts of resilience is support systems, emotional containment, emotional regulation, the ability to manage difficulty. These types of things, what we see in the research is that men are less likely to self-report as struggling emotionally than women. It's not socially acceptable for men to admit emotionality or what they perceive as weakness or vulnerability.
But also, if you self-report as struggling, isn't that kind of like a black mark?
Yes, exactly. So there's also the psychological safety of just, can I say this about myself? Is the business going to find out that I'm the one who wrote this and that I'm struggling? And I think both in a really situated perspective, like within the business, people are paranoid about that. But I think also as a whole in our society, there's a lot of stigma for men in admitting that there is emotionality or even being in touch with their emotionality. And even though studies show that men actually tend to be much more emotional in leadership positions than women,
They do, don't they?
yes, there's. I'll send you a piece of research afterwards. We can link it to the podcast
Yes,
if you'd
please,
like.
please. I would love that because I've always thought that. I make a joke, which is actually very true. I say we hire male CEOs and we spend millions teaching them to think like a woman. But I mean, it's very accurate. They're much more emotional. Right, love that.
And also, their hormones are most like women when we're menstruating. So that's when our hormone profiles are most similar. So I always find it quite funny to have these,
They are. What do
Yes.
you mean? Tell me
So
more.
this isn't my area of specialty, but
Yeah,
the
but
kind of
never mind the
levels
rest. This is
of it,
fascinating. No one's ever said
yeah,
that.
the levels of, because our hormones, of course, like dip throughout the month and they fluctuate in terms of estrogen and testosterone and progesterone. And the profile is most similar, apparently, to women when we're menstruating as with men. But going back to kind of the main point is that men typically don't self-report low resilience when it comes to the emotional components or the social components of resilience, which are very, very core components of resilience. And so what you'll see is women self-reporting lower levels of resilience because of the kind of the social acceptable nature of that. We're more socialized to be in touch with our emotions, to admit emotionality, to admit the need for social support, and to lean on social support, which ends up making us actually more resilient in these environments, but our self-reporting is lower. So you always have to take a bit of a critical view to how the data is coming back, and understand why people might be self-reporting in certain ways as
So
you're
there's
looking
a
at the
gender
gender
bias.
data.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and this is where qualitative research is always helpful in helping fill in those gaps. And so we quite often will do the quantitative surveys, but then spend time with the workforce doing a bit more of qualitative research to really understand the context and the detail behind what's actually happening in the organization.
And when you find out this information, how comfortable, even though they've hired you, how comfortable are leaders at hearing what you've told them?
Yeah, being willing to hear the hard thing is a very underrated leadership
Yeah, no, I
competency.
promise you, I'm a coach and I
Yes.
struggle. Like, I'm like, people are like, are you a lifestyle coach? I'm like, I'm a blunt coach. So
Yes.
don't hire me unless you want clarity. It's a very hard
Exactly.
thing, right?
It's very hard, and it is the biggest career and company limiting growth factor is
Yes.
people are that are not coachable or not willing to face the hard things. And so, and actually conflict competence. Patrick Lencioni talks about this in kind of the five dysfunctions of a team, but I've seen this in my research as well. And Dr. Becky, who's actually a child psychologist, talks about this in terms of kind of human resilience at a developmental level. Frustration tolerance and our ability to sit in the hard places and deal and really hold space for the hard things, both individually and as a group, is what creates that growth. That's really where we get to resilience. And if a
Like holding
business,
tension, isn't it?
exactly, holding tension and not personalizing it, right? Being curious about it and being willing to take accountability for it and engage with that. And that is such an underrated skill for growing companies in turbulence, because what worked for you and what got you here will not get you there. And so you have to be willing to see past your own limitations and take on additional expertise and get curious about what's failed or what's no longer working in this new context.
That is so interesting. What are the like anecdotally, what are the kind of responses you've gotten when you've said to a company, you have a huge problem here?
Yeah, I think you can begin to tell early on, and I think women are especially adept at this, or anyone who's operated in power imbalance before is adept at really understanding how well is this person going to respond to me pushing them or giving them hard information. And so we can kind of suss out quite early in our partnerships with our clients who is actually curious and willing to face the hard things and who is really trying to tick a box.
Yeah,
And
validation.
yeah, and I'm sure you run into this all the time in the DEI space. There's the wanting to tick the box to get it off your plate or feel good about having ticked that box. And then there's the real curiosity and commitment for impact. And those things are really different. And I think we're privileged to work with clients that fall into the latter bucket. They really care about impact. They really want to grow healthy. They want to retain people. And so they're willing to kind of wade into those deep places with us.
What is it that one thing I find really interesting? This is a little segue, I'm sorry, but while I've got you captive, I find it fascinating that we, when you look at organizations and when you look at corporates, and this is not my background, like my background was an M&A lawyer, so I was kind of part of that. And then I became an entrepreneur, and I was not been in corporate forever, but I now work in or sort of structure organization of a corporate. I find it on a strategic global level fascinating that when you get immense amounts of data, there is this irrelevance to the data. Like you can say women would be better at doing this, or women raise better companies. I was just thinking in terms of raising finance, because I was at Google yesterday at a fintech event, and they were talking about raising money and how women only raise 2% of whatever money. And it seems to be a very standard number across all kinds of things. How can you look at all the data about what is actually good for a company, like diversity of thought and diversity of all these things, and yet continue to completely ignore it? How does that work? What's the psychology? Yeah, but I mean, you need to understand some of it. I mean, I have you captive. What the heck is the psychology of that? I want to grow a business. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm desperate to grow. I will do anything to grow my business, husband it, move it, grow it, and I will absolutely ignore this piece of information. What is that?
It's bias. We are it's so interesting because we as human beings are we are irrational in if you just are looking at only following data, but we are very predictable in the sense that we are very identity driven. And so I actually love there's a researcher out of Harvard named Sheila Heen who talks about the blockers or the triggers that block us from receiving feedback. And I think essentially this is what you're asking. You're asking when we get new data about something that's not working or that could make us better, why don't we onboard it? And so she talks about a couple different blockers for being able to onboard or receive feedback or data that will make us better. And the first one's an accuracy trigger, so like a truth trigger. So if something's in our brain, we spot something inaccurate, we often throw out the whole thing. The second one is the like relational trigger. So if we don't trust the person that's telling us the information, we can discount that, which is
That's what happens. I keep hearing, oh, well, you can't trust McKinsey. And I'm like, that's okay. Here's someone else. And then they'll dismiss it.
Exactly. And so there's some trust issue, and which I actually think is a shame because often the people that we get on along with the least are the ones who see our edges. So they actually have the most interesting data about us, although McKinsey's an organization, so it's a bit different. But the third one is the most interesting one, and this is an identity trigger. And basically what happens is that when somebody brings a piece of information to us that taps onto a threat of how we've built our identity, a whole load of fight, flight, freeze, fawn kind of response comes online. We move out of our rational brain, out of our, complex problem-solving, open, creative, social connecting part of our nervous system and brain. And part of our brain kind of powers down and we go into lizard brain mode. And when we don't have full access to our complex problem-solving because we are under threat. And I think this is where a lot of mental gymnastics happens to protect what we think is our identity or keeping us safe versus really just engaging in curiosity about what we're learning and how that might actually help us evolve or improve. And this is why it's so important for leaders to do their own work. Because if leaders aren't actually doing their own work, embodying their own growth and health, then we have all sorts of automatic responses that are coming up that are actually really stunting our businesses. And as a coach, you know this. It's ourselves that get in
I've
the
got this
way.
very wry smile because I actually have never coached someone who hasn't made back what I've charged them minimum once, if not 20 times. I have one client who's made it back 1,034 times because we can't what they've paid me, never. And it's so interesting because it is the leaders don't understand that they are the feeder through everything. They're the block, they're the inspiration, they're everything, right?
And they're not just blocking themselves, they're actually blocking. If you are in a position of power, you are blocking the growth of all those below you. And so you really can only take the organization as far as you've taken yourself, and
Completely.
unless you release control and create, distribute that leadership beneath you, if you understand your limitations and your blind spots and really build a team to fill that out. But, that level of awareness around what's getting pulled up for me, that's a level of body based. So going back to the question around embodiment, that's a level of kind of body-based and emotional intelligence that requires real integration of self and real ownership of how you're showing up in that moment. And that's embodiment work. And that's really why we bring the body into this work when we talk about
Perfect.
resilience.
So that's what our last segment is going to be. And we're going to go on a quick break and we're going to come back. We're going to talk about embodiment because I find
Great.
I, from my background of running a health and wellness business for 15 years, I am absolutely committed to this. So we'll be back in a sec.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, we're back. How do we talk to me about embodiment? Because this, okay, so I'll preface this by saying that I've gone through a huge amount of change in the last 25 years of my life, and if 28 even. And I have consciously, every time I've made a change, embodied it physically one way or another, either by doing body work or by whatever the version is. And I do that with my clients. Like, I will never let them do mindset work without hitting their diets at the same time. I'm really conscious that what they're eating impacts how they're thinking and feeling and their support systems. But I've never heard anyone say that till I met you. So talk to me about the embodiment because I just think it's so important. I wouldn't sustain. It's like when you're a leader moving forward, you've got to take your team with you. I can't sustain what my brain and my heart want if I don't take my body with me.
I mean, you said it perfectly. So just to give you a picture of kind of where I am now in the embodiment work, I'll give you a little bit of backstory about why I got interested in this. And so my background was I was an elite athlete in the States. I played water polo, and then I coached for 10 years. And being in the sports world, which is, by the way, a very integrated mind-body world now, it was so clear to me how our body is affected, not only our own mental state and ability to perform, but also the social aspects of the team bonding, communication, performance. All of those things were such embodied practices. So I saw that real integration. But if you rewind back to maybe the 1960s, 1970s, the idea of mindset and emotional regulation in sports was very, very marginalized. It was very
Yeah.
non-centered, right? And
Which
now
is
you
interesting
see.
because Tom Brady will be, wildly open about the body
Yes.
work that he's doing that's enabled him to keep doing what he's doing. His diet is everything, right?
Exactly. And now you'll see in Wimbledon, you would see tennis players who are doing breath work and diaphragm releases to manage their nervous system. They're doing autonomic nervous system work on the court. And one of my favorite studies is actually one that looks at elite athletes, and it's the top 0.5% tennis players in the world and what separates them from the rest of the very, very, very talented athletes. And when they measured this, there was a moment of self-talk after failure where they would say in their mind to themselves, or even out loud, "That's all right, you've got this, back on the court." They would have this moment of positivity right afterwards, and it would actually affect their performance. And
Yeah, reframing.
there's been studies that have replicated this over and over and over again, to the point where now mindset training, mental resilience, emotional containment, and intelligence, all of these things are a huge part of an athlete's world. It's very integrated. And so, in the same way that sports used to just be all about physicality, and now it acknowledges that there's a physical and mental element to performance, I think it's flipped in the corporate world. In knowledge work, we think it's all about the brain.
Yeah.
And we have forgotten that the brain is working through the body, right? Our memories are actually stored in neurons in our gut. That's why we get gut feelings. It's pattern recognition that's
Absolutely.
happening in our brains, in our gut system. So if we can't access our pattern recognition software when we're trying to navigate as leaders complex situations, then we're missing part of our cognitive processing, and that's happening in your gut. And so when we talk about gut feelings, which of course can be biased and we have to be careful with some of these things, we need to be understanding the full body intelligence that's required to truly navigate these kind of complicated scenarios well. And so I started to think about what if we brought our bodies, and the way that you say this is, what if we brought our biology to work? What if we brought our whole systems online to work in a way that was not only credible, but also safe, specifically for women and non-normative bodies in these spaces? And so I did, when I went to LSE to do my master's in organizational psychology, and I got to choose an area of research to kind of focus on for 8 months. This was my area of research. And I looked at, to your point about how you used to coach and how you continue to coach and integrating the two, what happens if we bring the body into the leadership development process? What differences do we see? And because of my background in coaching and Pilates teaching and all of this, I was able to bring in actual movement and breath work and somatic experience into this case study that I built of executive female leadership workshops. And we got to measure really the impact of how movement really moves us in ways that are non-physical. And so what are the social, emotional, kind of political knock-on effects of bringing our bodies to work as women in leadership positions? And the results, I anticipated they would be good, but they really blew me away.
Wow.
And what we saw was this incredible generative and mediating power of the body to help us show up connected, creative, resourced, and also emancipated. So women really being able to take up space rather than being contorted in these leadership spaces. And so I think there's just a load of promise for us as we look at how do we continue to solve really complex problems in the world and take up more space as women in the body. And the body has a lot to offer in that area.
Yeah, because it's kind of our home, right? It's our home, it's our foundation. Because we talked about this before we came on, but when you're ill, you can achieve nothing.
It's
And
right.
so
It's very hard. Yes.
it's super hard
You
because
realize
it's
how
healthy.
embodied you are when you're over a toilet bowl with the stomach flu. I mean, that is when it's inescapable that we live in bodies,
And
right?
that thing of
Yeah.
brain fog and whatever,
Exactly.
all of that stuff. And this is something that COVID has brought home to so many people. And it was much harder because I've been doing this since 2008. And it was much, much harder to tell people this before. But post-COVID, I really get zero pushback. People
Yeah.
are like, okay. And because you can't anymore, you've got to, as a C-suite exec, as a senior successful professional, as any kind of successful person, if you don't treat yourself as an athlete of some kind, you are failing because it's not
Right.
good enough, right? I see that again and again and again. But then those are also the people that will struggle to, you, it's almost like a terrible thing to say, but it's almost like a profile. You can see they'll struggle to accept new information. They'll struggle to make changes. They'll struggle to advance, and I see it when I'm coaching.
Right.
And when people come in to coach, I have this memory of this, he runs one of the largest construction companies in the world. And I remember that he's very tall, slightly overweight man. And I remember thinking, this is going to be so difficult. Well, firstly, I don't think he'd ever met anyone who wasn't white, but that was another story. And then a woman who sounded and spoke like me was like, whoa, another thing. But I was like, wow, we're just going to struggle here because you want to be right all the time, And so, and being right is more important than moving forward. And it was a really interesting, and we did go on to coach for a year and a half, 2 years. This movement, I just charged him a lot more because I was like, going to be really
Energetic
hard.
cost. But I love the way that you described that, because what you described as being right versus moving is really signals, even in your language, a rigidity and a standing still and a stuckness versus an agility and an evolving. And I think, what we're looking for as leaders is we're looking for agility. We're looking for flexibility. That is what helps us navigate turbulence and change and neuroplasticity. We want to grow. We want to get better. And the body is what facilitates all of those things. So, a flexible nervous system and a resourced nervous system is one that is able to handle stress and change. And neuroplasticity, movement, is one of the key things that helps us kind of access those neurotransmitters that help develop new neural
But
pathways and grow.
do you not find, like, I run into a problem with people who are already successful, Because when you're saying to them, you know, there's a level of success, and they're like, I'm already making 25 million or whatever it is, you know. And you can see that. How do you manage that when you have people that are already like this guy was literally the second, third largest construction company and wildly successful. So, and I remember a coach really struggling to explain the point of what I did until I asked him, are you happy? Not are you rich, because we can see that. And the damn private plane you flew in on is, you know, evidence enough, but are you happy? And I remember him looking at me really blankly because he had no understanding that happiness was supposed to be on the menu. Right? There was no entitlement to happiness, but there was a huge entitlement to the success. But the success wasn't a wide enough definition to include him as a person. And I found that fascinating.
Yeah, it is really I think questions are the most powerful tool when you're working with someone who believes they have the answers, because at some point they're going to reach for the answer and it's not going to be there if you ask enough right questions. But that is the other thing, is that it takes two. And so in these types of co coaching and growth relationships, I think we're going back to that coachability point, which is you can't force somebody to grow, right? And
No.
so sometimes suffering and change gives somebody a very, very big invitation to do that. But even still, as I kind of move through life and see more and more people deal with, everyone's handed some type of suffering along the way, and some people truly choose to double down and not to use as an opportunity to expand, and other people lean in. And the second one is really the definition of resilience, and that's what we're looking for at an organizational level, and that takes structures and learning systems and competency dealing with the uncomfy places, both individually and at a team level. And it's a hard thing to achieve, but it's needed more and more and more in today's context with how quickly the world is changing.
But also, you guys, with the work that you do, you directly kind of link resilience to ROI, right?
It's nice in areas, for instance, like M&A, we had talked about, for our clients that are going through M&A processes, because there is such an attention to value creation. And if we can minimize the inevitable dips and get to good faster, there is a real ROI direct line between those things. It's harder in situations when you're dealing with unplanned changes in the market to understand, how badly would we have dealt with this if we didn't have this resilience built in?
No,
That's
exactly.
the
Because
kind
you
of
can't show
constant,
the downside. You end up only
right? There's no
measuring the
control
truth.
group. So we can't
No, it's very
exactly
true.
measure.
But and that's my legal background. I keep notes because I'm like, I know that in 3 months, 6 months, you're not going to remember. So I'm like, let me just read back our original notes. And they're like, oh my God, you're such a bitch. I'm like, I know. So we're just going to, let's see where you came from, you know? Because you don't remember, because the shift is so incrementally small, but so with the work that you do, the work that I do, you come from a different arena, but what we're doing is shifting people. But that shift is not something that they're going to slide backwards, because once you know, you can't unknow it. But it's really hard to track it. So yeah,
It is. And it's helpful
fascinating.
to do it socially as well. So to have team feedback, to have people connected to their partners and their communities in this work, so that they can, and this is true in all my personal relationships as well. For all of the people in my life that are on growth journeys, we're able to reflect back to each other. I just had a milestone birthday this weekend. I turned 40, and I
Happy
had women,
birthday.
thank you. I had women around me that were reflecting to me because I had forgotten what had happened in the last decade. And they were reflecting to me, let's think about all of these areas that you've grown and you've been resilient and you've broken cycles and you've created this whole new thing. And so it's helpful to have people also reflect back to you what is so easily forgotten in your own growth journey. And that's why the social elements are so important as well when it comes to embedding this in a company.
Yeah, no, I completely agree because it is so vitally important. Marina, thank you so much for joining me. We could keep doing this for another couple of hours, I feel. But I
Thank you.
appreciate your time. I really appreciate having you on. We'll have all the details to contact you and everything in the show notes.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Gita. Love the work that you're doing, and I'm so excited to be a part of W Corp.
Yeah, me too. Icing on the cake. My name is Geeta Sidhu Rob, and this is Activate Yourself. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope this was fascinating for you, because it is the bedrock of all good change and where we're all trying to go. So I hope this gave you something to think about and something that you learned, and I will be with you again soon.
Thank you so much for joining us. Our goal was to give you pause, make you think about your life, and inspire you to say, wow, what if I tried to do that? If they can do it, so can I. Did it work? Let us know by finding us on social media at Geeta Sidhu Rob or at Nosh Detox. We upload new shows every 2 weeks here. And if you start to miss us, check us out on YouTube.